and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with The American Dream in Crisis, which is the subtitle of Robert Putnam's new book, Our Kids, a powerful compendium of social and economic research which gets to the heart of the issues that underlie the current political campaigns. The author of the classic bestseller Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, Robert Putnam addresses the source of the populist anger on the right and left as growing income inequality, the downsized middle class, and the diminishing horizons in the land of opportunity are making the American dream increasingly out of reach as America becomes less socially mobile and more of a class society. Robert Putnam, the Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University and the former Dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, who has been consulted by Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, joins us to discuss the fate and future of our families, schools, and communities. Then we are joined in the studio by Robin Yassin Kassab, a media commentator on Syria, and Leila Al-Shami, a founding member of Tahrir ICN, a network that aims to connect anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. They are the authors of the new book just out, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. And we will look into the modern-day political and humanitarian nightmare that Syria has become and explore the slow-motion death of a country before the eyes of the world, from the initial grassroots uprising when Syrians took to the streets demanding freedom and dignity, to the present shaky ceasefire and peace talks to end a civil war that has become a proxy war and could explode into a regional war. And joining us now is Robert Putnam, a professor of public policy at Harvard University and the former dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's the founder of the Saguaro Seminar, a program dedicated to fostering civic engagement in America, and is the author and co-author of a dozen books, including Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, Better Together, Restoring the American Community, Making Democracy Work, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. And his latest book just out is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Putnam.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's good to be back with you.
And Bob, your book begins with your graduation from high school in Port Clinton, Ohio, in the 1959, where you felt that there was no trace of bias against kids from humbler backgrounds. And in a way, here in California, we could sort of make the connection, I think, of what's happened to education in this country, because back then in 59, California was seen as the model for education, higher education in particular, and it was in many ways the envy of the world, and now it's sunk to the bottom near Mississippi. So what's happened?
Well, that's my impression, too, of what's happened in California and to some extent other places, too. That is that we've disinvested in public education and especially at the college level. So I agree with that, and I think it's really too bad. But I wouldn't want to leave the impression that the growing gap between rich kids and poor kids in America, which is the subject of this new book, Our Kids, is driven primarily by something that's happening in schools. The basic evidence of this new book is that by many, many measures over the last 30 or 40 years, the resources and opportunities available to kids coming from affluent, well-educated homes have gotten better and better, whereas the same resources and opportunities available to kids coming from what we used to call the working class have gotten worse and worse. So there's a growing gap between what I'm loosely calling rich kids and poor kids. And of all of the factors in American society that have contributed to that growing class gap among our young people, things that happen in schools are actually probably not a major contributing factor. Most people begin by thinking, well, it must be due to schools. But we've, in America, developed a bad habit of causing problems ourselves and then blaming the schools for not fixing them. I'm not saying that if we want to reverse this growing gap, schools aren't part of the solution. They are part of the solution. But I don't want to begin with your listeners thinking that this is yet another problem the schools cause. These opportunities that the rich kids are bringing to school and the challenges the poor kids are bringing to school are things that they carry in their backpack. When rich kids go to school, they carry their parents' aspirations and their parents' resources and the fact that their parents have read to them and so on as they were growing up. That is what they carry in their backpack, and that helps all the kids in high-income schools. And when poor kids go to school, in their backpacks they carry gang violence from their neighborhoods and problems from their own home. And those things also disrupt the educational process for all the poor kids. So I do think that we have disinvested in public education exactly as you said, and I think that restoring our investments in education would be a really good idea because schools are part of the society's mechanism for equalizing opportunity. But I wouldn't want your listeners to think that it was the schools that caused the problem in the first place.
So in other words, it's not about money entirely or solely, but is it about focus? Because in many ways, education should not just be about preparing kids for jobs, but preparing kids for citizenship. And it does seem that we, as a society, we're becoming more fractured, more atomized. And we have in this particular election year some calls from candidates to come together. But clearly, the consensus is that we're drifting apart as a society.
That's right. And I think that's the big master trend, Ian. Look, there are at least three big factors that then combine to cause this growing gap between rich kids and poor kids. First, of course, is the growing inequality in the distribution of income. That is, the distribution of income between rich families and poor families has gotten less and less equal as folks on the upside have gotten richer and richer, and people from about the middle of the income distribution down to the bottom haven't had a raise in the last 20 or 30 years. So that's an important part of the problem, and that's been discussed, of course, a lot in the elections. Another part of the story, actually, that is less well known, but it may even be more important, is that we've become a more segregated society in terms of where we live. That is, increasingly Americans are living either in affluent enclaves with other affluent people or in impoverished neighborhoods with other poor people, and fewer of us are living in mixed or moderate income neighborhoods. And that means, for example, that our kids are increasingly going to school with other kids like them. If we're well off, then they're increasingly going to school with affluent kids who are bringing their parents' support and resources to school. Or if we're poor, then our kids are increasingly going to schools which are only inhabited by other poor kids. And that social segregation is more or less independent of the growing inequality in income, and that segregation also is causing part of the problem. And then the third big factor is the collapse of the family and community institutions and what we used to call the working class, so that now, unlike 30 or 40 years ago, of all kids in America who are growing up in high school educated homes, that is what we used to call the working class, nearly 70% of them are growing up in single-parent families. That's of all races. This is not about race. It's about social class. And that means it's just harder to raise kids if there's only one parent in the home. And that means that these working-class kids are increasingly starting off behind the eight ball. And that distinction between kids coming from affluent homes, living in affluent neighborhoods, and with two parents are, even very early in their lives, they're set on a more optimistic and track than kids coming from poorer homes in poorer neighborhoods and largely with fragile families.
So is there, though, I mean, there were many calls for this sort of atavistic idea of returning to the kind of nuclear family of Ozzie and Harriet, back in the 50s when you graduated, this idea that those were the halcyon days, and that in many ways that we should return to those halcyon days. But were they an accurate portrait of the full spectrum of American life? In other words, in many ways it seems that African Americans and Latinos were pretty invisible back in those days. And as you know, in this particular election year, there is a sort of, in a way, a bifurcation going on in the politics where, on particularly with people like Donald Trump, are attracting kind of angry white voters and alienating a growing constituency of Latino and African Americans.
Well, Ian, you've asked a lot of different questions there, not a single question. I'll try to parse them out. First of all, were the 1950s a halcyon day for all Americans? Absolutely not, and I make that clear in my discussion of my own hometown. There was a lot of racism, and there was certainly a gender bias as well. So has America made progress in racial and gender equality? Well, we've made a lot of progress on gender equality, and that's great. And we've made some progress on racial equality, although not nearly as much as we need. So in those domains, America was not a halcyon society. And I want to come back to the issues of race in a minute, but you began by asking me not about race and gender, but about family structure, and saying, you know, well, that was all maybe fictitious family harmony of an Aussie and Harriet family. The fact of the matter is that the family structure that's overwhelmingly typical of college-educated homes in America today is a only slightly modified version of Ozzie and Harriet. More than 90% of kids growing up in the upper-middle class homes or upper-class homes in America, that is, college-educated homes, more than 90% of them are growing up in two-parent families. The modal family now in America is like Ozzie and Harriet, except that Harriet now has a job. She's working as a lawyer, and therefore the family has a little more income, and Ozzie is helping out a little bit more with the dishes and the kids. But basically, the structure of the family is mom, dad, and the kids. Where mom's going out to work, that's an important difference, but other than that, the structure is very traditional, neo-traditional it's called, and stable. But over that same period, a very different family structure, much more fragile, much more kaleidoscopic, actually, with parents, with adults moving into and out of the house, often kids in the house that are step siblings, or the relationship either never was a marriage, or if it is a marriage, the marriage is much more fragile. And I'm not making a moral point about that, but the fact of the matter is, people who study family structure from all ideological points of view now agree that it's easier to raise kids if you've got two adults, the parents of the child or the children, in the household. And it's not a matter of blaming the single moms at all, but it is a matter of saying it would be a lot. They and their kids would be a lot better off if we, the rest of us, enabled them to have or helped them to have a stable two parent family. And many of them would like that, but the economics of it have changed, and therefore we don't have that. And to call the two parent family atavistic, actually, I think, is to misstate what the evidence is. It's not atavistic. It's better for kids if they have two parents in the home. Now, to go back to the elections, which is another question you ask about, I agree completely that this issue we're talking about is reflected in the election campaign this year. And in part, the people who are supporting Mr. Trump represent, actually, the less well-educated white males who have, let's be honest, have really taken it on the chin over the last 30 or 40 years. They and their kids, the rest of us, have frankly neglected over the last 30 or 40 years. I am not now engaging in comparative victimology because, of course, lots of non-white families and guys and women have also suffered over these period. But what I think we have to be careful in thinking about is, I think, honestly, myself, that Trump is exploiting that the very real grievances of that group of people in by directing them in a classically authoritarian way against the other, that is, against women and against immigrants and against blacks, convincing those guys that their problems are caused by women and ethnic minorities. It isn't true, but this is not the first time in world history in which people with real grievances have been exploited by demagogues to redirect their anger away from the serious causes of their problems and toward outsiders or alien forces. I think, to some extent, the rest of us who've done pretty well over the last 30 or 40 years and have been ignoring the problems of low-income Americans, we are, you know, partly implicated in this situation, even though now we're appalled by the idea that Donald Trump is channeling that anxiety and that fear and that anger even in a very, very unproductive way.
Let's just take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Robert Putnam.
It's just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know
by. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation today with Robert Putnam, the professor of public policy at Harvard University and the former dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government and the founder of the Saguaro Seminar, a program dedicated to fostering civic engagement. He's the author of a number of best-selling books, including Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. And his latest book, now out in paperback, is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. So given that about, I think it's something like 45% of households are now headed by a woman who in most cases, I believe, is the sole breadwinner. What do we do as a society you can't legislate love, you can't legislate responsibility. You can obviously help people who in need, particularly single mothers. But how do you really address this issue in terms of political engagement?
Well, I would say there are a number of things that we can do as a practical matter. Let me also, just in passing, mention to your readers that in addition to the book Our Kids that is now out in paperback, my research team has, with the cooperation of 50 experts from across the country, bipartisan experts from across the country, just put online a 75-page compendium of policies that we could pursue that would begin to narrow the opportunity gap. And one of the chapters in that new publication called Closing the Opportunity Gap, and you can find it at theopportunitygap.com, one of the chapters in that is devoted to family structure and parenting. And so I'm now going to sort of channel the things that these experts across the country have said in response to your question. Obviously, we can't legislate. We can't demand that people, before they have kids, get a license of some sort. I think that what experts say would be helpful is, first of all, giving a substantial increase in wages and economic stability to less well-off, poor men and women, because a part of the problem that we can see in the data has caused the collapse of the working class family is the collapse of the working class economy, the manufacturing economy. And so things that we could do, like raising the minimum wage, for example, that would or raising the earned income tax credit and making the earned income tax credit available to men as well as to women, that would encourage over the long run restoring of the working class family. In addition, there are well-established programs now that can help provide support and counseling, coaching really, to single parents, many of whom themselves have never actually lived ever in a stable family because their own families, when they were growing up, were also unstable, and therefore they don't really have a terrific understanding of what you need to do to raise kids nowadays. And so there are well-established programs that provide parental counseling and that would help those parents to be more helpful to their kids. Thirdly, we can provide early childhood education, and I don't just mean pre-K. I mean from 0 to 4, which we now know would have a big positive effect, a huge positive effect on narrowing the opportunity gap, narrowing the so-called word gap. That is, when I say word gap, I mean there's this statistic that the average upper middle class kid, before he or she gets to school, has heard 30 million more words than the average kid coming from what we used to call the working class. And the reason that's important is we know from recent brain science that that is a powerful predictor. That is, interacting and, you know, reading your kids and so on is a powerful predictor of how well kids are going to do in life. So those are just some of the ways in which we can help working class parents, and including single moms, to we can help them to do a better job of raising their kids. It's not they don't want to do a good job of raising their kids, but they're overcome partly by the constraints of their own experience and partly by economics from doing the same kind of parenting job that upper middle class families are able to afford.
So in terms then of social democracy, which we have had sort of fits and starts. So we seem to sort of oscillate as a society between sort of democracy and plutonomy. And you can go back to the early Gilded Age, for an example, and then there was the Roaring Twenties, and then there was the Depression, and I guess from about 47 to 77, there was more of a social democracy. And then since Ronald Reagan's presidency, it's sort of drifted more towards plutonomy. These ebbs and flows, is building a social democracy at the heart of it? I know one of the candidates running for president has tried to make that case, but obviously you can't turn the United States into Denmark overnight. But it would seem that in many ways, in terms of civic engagement, in terms of education, teaching civics, that, you know, in your book, Bob Putnam, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, you do lament the fact that the poor people in this country don't vote. So how much is that a component here that needs to be revived?
Ian, I'm actually optimistic that we can solve this problem. And I want to say why I'm optimistic, because it's a direct answer to the really good question you've just posed. The reason I'm optimistic that Americans can solve the problem, this growing opportunity gap and growing inequality in America, is that we have been here before. And you mentioned the most important previous episode in our history, the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th century. Then the gap between rich and poor was very high and growing. It was as high then as it would ever be in American society until now. So then and now, we had a big gap between rich and poor. Then and now, we had a high rate of immigration that was causing turbulence and upset in America. Then and maybe now, we had a high rate of political corruption. Then and maybe now, many Americans thought the political parties weren't doing their job in helping us to grapple with these problems, and there were many other deep parallels between then and now, not least of which was that then the public philosophy was something called social Darwinism, which was a hokey kind of pseudoscientific theory that basically the bottom line of which was said that we would all be better off if everyone was just selfish and the devil take the hindmost. That was a kind of a that was a period very much like the period we're in now. And then, in a relatively short period of time, Americans recognized the problem and began to fix it. And let me just say very quickly what I mean by that. The first stage in that was Americans recognizing how big the gaps in American society had grown. That was especially made vivid in a book by a Danish-American journalist who published a book in 1890 called How the Other Half Lives, which was simply a description of life in the tenement slums of the Lower East Side of New York, meant to be read in the silk stocking districts of the Upper East Side of New York. And he essentially said, this is, I'm talking about Jacob Riis, he essentially said to the folks on the Upper East Side of New York, look, do you realize what life is like down just 10 miles from you? And are you happy living in that kind of an America? And, of course, some of the rich folks said, sure, not my problem, their problem. But some of the people said, actually, no, I'm not comfortable living in that kind of an America. And from that book evolved in New York a reform movement aided by a young politician named Teddy Roosevelt, that began to make real changes. So first of all, recognizing the problem. And then there are a lot of other changes. I just want to mention one in particular because I think it's highly relevant to our own time. In order to begin to narrow the opportunity gap then, and I'm talking about 1910, plus or minus a few years, in 1910, Americans invented, for the first time in world history, the high school. By that I mean, by high school I mean free, public, 4 years of secondary education available to any kid in town, just because they were a kid. And nowhere else in the world at that point had any town tried to do that. There were, of course, private high schools that were available to rich kids, but not for the whole country. And this innovation began in small towns in the Midwest, in Iowa and Kansas and Nebraska. It spread very rapidly across the country. It was not an easy sell because you had to convince the affluent folks in town who had already paid for their kids to get a secondary education, a private schooling education, and their kids now were off in, you know, Chicago making money. You had to convince them that they should pay for other people's kids to get a secondary education. A hard sell, but it worked, and it was turned out to be the best decision American has ever made because it did two things at once that economists tell us you can't do together. That is, it raised the overall growth rate of the United States so much that that one decision, the economic historians tell us, accounts for most of the economic growth in America during the whole of the 20th century. Huge deal, probably doubled our national productivity at a stroke. And at the same time, it leveled the playing field so that the rich kids in the poor kids in town were started off a little more on an equal footing with the rich kids in town. Now, it was a terrific decision. It alone made everybody better off, but especially leveled the playing field and laid the groundwork for a half century of unusually high upward mobility. Now, a couple of things about that story. First, the idea did not come from Harvard, and the innovation did not come from Washington, or, for that matter, from L.A. or from New York. It came from ordinary people in ordinary towns in the middle of America trying to solve their version of the larger problem. How can we help all the kids in town? Secondly, it depended upon all the folks, the adults in those towns, having the ability to conceive that all the kids in town were our kids. It wasn't just their own biological kids they should be worrying about. They should be worrying about other people's kids, too. And thirdly, it began at the grassroots and then spread rapidly across the country and eventually also reached Washington. Now, in short, what I'm trying to say, and this is relevant to the question you asked about Sanders and his views, I am not saying that America should become like Denmark. Denmark is a very different place. It might be a nice place to live, but it's very small and it's very homogeneous, and we're never going to make America Denmark. That's not the right way to think about the problem. I'm saying we need to make America what we used to be. That is, this is America that I'm talking about, not that long ago in historical terms. So we've done this before, and we could do it again if we begin to think about these poor kids as our kids and not just as somebody else's kids.
So having a millennial daughter who I have an understanding of the angst that these kids are going through with their student debt, etc. And in many ways, we have examples where kids have become profit centers. Not only are they indebted before they get a job and their job opportunities have somewhat diminished, you have essentially rackets like for-profit colleges, which take up about $30 to $40 billion of taxpayers' money, which is a bipartisan disgrace in Washington, D.C. So my sense is that we should not be making kids profit centers, but investment centers. And I think that's pretty much what you're arguing, isn't it?
Absolutely. The reason to worry about this problem is not merely that it's unfair and that it's a problem of the growing opportunity gap. It's unfair and it's un-American. Americans have fundamentally always believed that, you know, people could be successful, but how successful you were should depend upon you and your hard work and your talents and not on what your parents did or didn't do. And increasingly, we're moving into a world already in which what the most important thing that you, the most important decision you ever make is choosing your parents, and that's fundamentally un-American. But it's also economically really costly. The best econometric estimates of the costs to the rest of us from not adequately investing in poor kids is, over the course of their lifetime, that cost amounts to $5 trillion, trillion with a T. Partly that's because of the increased cost of the criminal justice system. More important is the increased health care cost, because these poor kids, because they're getting such a poor start in life, are going to get sick earlier and more seriously and more often, and the rest of us are going to end up somehow paying the bill for that. But the main reason why it's so costly is we can't afford to throw away the talents of these poor kids. The chances that a high test-scoring, smart, poor kid in America today will actually get a college degree are lower than the chances that a low-scoring kid from a rich family will get a college degree. Now, I'm not upset about, you know, less able rich kids getting a college degree, but we ought to all worry about the fact that some of our brightest kids, the people who could actually, you know, discover a cure for cancer or develop a new app or God knows what, certainly contribute to the growth of all of us, a very high fraction of those smartest kids are not able to contribute to the economy, not because of their talent, they've got talent, but because of their choice of parents. And that's really wasteful. So that's why I absolutely agree with you. It's not a matter of thinking of kids as a profit center, and I certainly agree with you that these for-profit colleges and universities are frankly, a travesty. It's a disgrace that they're able to exploit these poor kids the way they are and exploit the taxpayers. But we really ought to think in the interest of all of us. I worry about my own grandchildren, who are going to do just fine personally, but they're going to be living in a poorer America if we don't adequately invest in the poor kids in America.
Well, Robert Putnam, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks a lot, Ian. I enjoyed talking with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Putnam, who is a professor of public policy at Harvard University and the former dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government. He's the founder of the Saguaro Seminar, a program dedicated to fostering civic engagement in America, and is the author and co-author of a dozen books, including Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. And his latest book, just out in paperback, is Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studios by the author of the new book just out, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War.
جيتني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us in the studio is Robin Yassin Kassab, a media commentator on Syria and the Middle East and the author of the novel The Road from Damascus, and a contributor to Syria Speaks. And also joining us in studio is Leila Al-Shami, who is a founding member of Tahrir ICN, a network that aims to connect anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. They are the authors of the new book just out, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Al-Shami.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And Leila, let me begin with you in terms of, obviously, it's good to have some time to go over this agonizing history of this country that is literally being destroyed before our eyes. We've seen it. It's a slow-motion catastrophe. And obviously, later in the year when it's either settled of who's running on the Democratic side and who's running on the Republican side, it's likely to be Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side by all accounts. And I'm sure a lot of recriminations are going to come up in terms of foreign policy debates. So the question would be then, what could have been done or should have been done to have avoided this catastrophe? Was it something that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, obviously they could have handled it differently and could have handled it better, but could they have prevented this agony?
Well, yes, I mean, you're absolutely right. Over the past 5 years, Syria has suffered, or the Syrian people have suffered an immense human tragedy. We're now in a situation where 500,000 people have been killed. More than half the population is no longer living in their own homes. 5 million of them have fled the country for safety as refugees. But this started as a popular struggle. It started as a struggle which was calling for more political freedoms and was also calling for issues of economic justice, a popular struggle that was met by intense brutality by the Assad regime. Yes, certainly Syrians have been let down by the West and by the whole world. There should have been more support to them. Certainly in 2012-2013, when Assad was being pushed out of large parts of the country, that was the right time to support the Free Syrian Army and the people that were struggling to defend their communities from assault with weapons, so that they were able to do that. And that just didn't happen. And as a result of that, what we've seen is the rise of extremist Islamist groups, because the Free Syrian Army was significantly weakened and Islamist groups got the support that they need. So yes, the West should have supported more in 2012-2013, and then we wouldn't have been in the situation where large parts of the country have been devastated by this war.
And Robin Yassin Kassab, there are reports that I've heard mostly from Syrian opposition figures that obviously the Assad mantra from day one has been it's either me or the terrorists. So how did the terrorists become, in effect, oblige that narrative? Because clearly there's a lot of ambivalence on the Western side, and there has been from day one. There hasn't been ambivalence on the Assad side. The Russians have known exactly what they want. Hezbollah knows what it wants. And the Iranians, the IRGC, and Assad, they all know what they want. Our side only knows what it doesn't want, but it doesn't know what it wants. Mm. And some of the rumors suggest that even Assad himself had a hand in creating the terrorist opposition.
Absolutely.
Because he had all of those jihadis that went off, that he encouraged to fight in Iraq against the Americans. When they came back, they were all imprisoned. And then supposedly he let them loose to form ISIS. So is there anything to those rumors?
Oh, it's more than rumors. I mean, it's been confirmed again and again and again, and it's well known that in the early days of the uprising, which then became a revolution from in the spring and the summer of 2011, President Assad released 1,500 people from prison in what he described as an amnesty for political prisoners. If you look at who those people were, the vast majority of them, as you say, were Salafist jihadists, extremist Islamists, who he had facilitated their passage to Iraq during the American occupation of Iraq. Sometimes they fought American troops. More often, they were helping to precipitate a civil war between Sunni and Shia in Iraq, which helped to destroy that country and led to where we are now with ISIS and so on. When they came back, when the surviving members of these groups came back to Syria, he put them in prison, as you said, and he kept them there until he needed them, which was when the revolution broke out. At the same moment that he was rounding up tens of thousands of peaceful, non-violent, non-sectarian protesters, he was rounding these people up for death by torture, for indefinite detention. They disappeared into his gulag at the same time he released these Salafist jihadists from prison. And according to some high-level defectors, it went further than that. He actually helped logistically, helped them to set up their militias. Why did he do this? Precisely, as you say, because he wanted to scare the West with the possibility that, look, the only choice in Syria is me. I may be a fascist, but I shave and I wear a necktie. The other alternative is these fascists with long beards who don't just want to rule Syria, they want to come and blow up people in Europe and America and so on. So there we are. The world now sees ISIS as the greater evil. It certainly is an evil, but it's a symptom rather than a cause. President Assad and his scorched earth policy and his deliberate manipulation of these terrorist groups, his deliberate manipulation of sectarianism inside Syria and the region has led to this absolute disaster. And as you were saying earlier, President Obama is, in the name of withdrawal, he vetoed other powers which wanted to give anti-aircraft weapons to the Free Syrian Army. He stopped that happening. He did a deal with Iran. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing a deal with Iran, but he did a deal with Iran at precisely the moment when Iranian policy in the region takes a very dangerous turn and they send tens of thousands of occupation troops and transnational Shia jihadists to fight on Assad's front line. In Iraq, Obama is even providing American air cover, not for the National Iraqi Army in its battle with ISIS, but for Iranian-backed Shia militias, which is just making the problem worse. This is just encouraging this kind of extremist Sunni identity politics. So, yeah, I do think that America could have done much better. It seems to have decided to hand over Syria and Iraq not to the people in those countries who are trying to have a say in how their countries are run, but to more savage imperialist powers, Russia and Iran in this case.
And again, in the studio with me is Robin Yassin Kassab, who is a media commentator on Syria and the Middle East and the author of the novel The Road from Damascus and a contributing editor to Syria Speaks. And also in the studio with us is Leila Alshami, who is a founding member of Tahrir ICN, a network that aims to connect anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. They are the authors of the new book just out, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. Well, clearly, obviously, the revolution against the Assad family business, which is Syria, that's the sort of the family plantation. And of course, you're both, I take it, living in the UK.
Yes.
Where Bashar al-Assad was living had a practice as an ophthalmologist, and he had to come back to Syria because his older brother, the designate Basil, I think was killed driving a Ferrari too fast.
That's absolutely right.
I believe.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing to think that leftists in the West think of these people as revolutionaries, the Assads. It's just mind-boggling. When, just like Gaddafi, they're a bunch of capitalist gangsters whose sons' only virtues are that they drive expensive cars fast. But clearly, the Libyan revolution was a huge spark for the Syrian revolution. But on the Assad side, it seems that he also learned from Gaddafi. Gaddafi, of course, was about to kill everybody in Benghazi when the UN and the US got involved, and that's when Putin felt he got used by Obama. Assad adopted a sort of slow motion massacre, didn't he? And where he didn't sort of just kill a whole city at once, he just sort of did it gradually and incrementally.
I think that's very true. Assad knew that probably a large-scale immediate assault would precipitate a Western intervention. But he also knew that if it was a steady escalation of violence, he would likely get away with continuing the violence. And also because of the backlash to that. I mean, as the violence increased by the regime, this is when a popular struggle turns into a military struggle. And Bashar al-Assad knew that he couldn't win a reform process. He knew that he couldn't gain support to stay in power from the West if he was facing solely peaceful protests. And for this reason, the violence escalated and he provoked a war.
Well, there was a period, and I'm not sure exactly when, but both the Saudis and the French were prepared to launch airstrikes, and the French had brought in the aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle off the coast of Syria. The Saudis had deployed a lot of aircraft ready to strike, and at the last minute they came to Obama and said, you know, just give us the overflight protection against missiles, and the U.S. has abilities to jam ground-to-air missiles and obviously has the ability to shoot down interceptors. So that was what they required of the U.S., but Obama turned them down largely because Sarkozy was up for re-election and he felt he was being used. So had, for example, the attack against the palaces, which was basically what they were going to do, bomb the called regime decapitation, what would have resulted? I mean, in other words, this has always been, the complaint has always been that nothing was done, but then you have to work through what could have been done and what the ramifications would have been had they done what people are arguing they should have done.
Well, the regime needed to be neutralised. Personally, my view is I'm against foreign intervention. I'm against direct foreign intervention. What I think needed to have been done was that the people on the ground, the Syrian people themselves, those that took up arms to defend themselves from the regime, should have been properly supported. They should have been provided specifically with the anti-aircraft missiles that they needed to stop the very savage aerial attacks that communities were being subjected to. And of course, one of the very negative positions that America has taken was not to arm the Free Syrian Army, but also to prevent other states that were willing to give weapons to the Free Syrian Army from being able to do so.
Well, but when they do give arms, and famously, of course, I can't remember how much money was, I think $500 million was spent, and the Pentagon announced a complete failure. I believe that the CIA's efforts were a little bit better, but at the end of the day, the reports have been that most of the arms, including these latest TOW missiles, that are given to the Free Syrian Army end up with the jihadists. So, Robin, what's this? Why has the, apart from the fact that the FSA haven't been sufficiently supported by the West, when they do, they appear to also basically, the arms end up in the wrong hands. So
I think that has happened sometimes. It hasn't happened very often. I think it's actually the case that it isn't the USA usually which supplies the TOW missiles. It's usually Saudi Arabia with American permission. That's why it starts and stops. When the Americans want to make a point, then a few are allowed through. And then when they want to stop making that point, suddenly they dry up. So there's never been a consistent, organized supply. If there had been in 2012, for example, a consistent, centralized supply of the real weapons that people need, specifically anti-aircraft weapons, it would have looked very different. The Free Syrian Army would have been able to, which isn't really an army, it's a collection of more than 1,000 self-defense militias. And if there had been centralized, sufficient arming starting in 2012, by now it would look like an army. It would be able to impose discipline on its local affiliates, and the appeal of Islamist groups would be far less. The reason why people turned to Islamist groups in most cases was not because they were ideologically Islamist. It was because these groups had pre-existent logistical networks. They could provide ammunition. They could even find funds to pay a fighter a small salary, which he could send to his family in a refugee camp. They could feed their fighters. These are why people joined. There was actually, in 2012, some research done, which found that 60% of fighters in of Syrian fighters in Ahrar al-Sham and Jabhat al-Nusra, which is one fairly extreme all-Syrian Salafist militia, and Jabhat al-Nusra is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Apparently 60% of the fighters said that their preferred model of state in the future was not an Islamic state, but a civil state. Mm-hmm. So 60% of the men, even in the al-Qaeda franchise at that stage at least, had not joined up because they were ideologically on board with al-Qaeda. They joined up simply for reasons of survival, because they could get ammunition. So the Americans and others were very worried, oh, if we add weapons into this, maybe jihadists will get hold of it. And that happened in a few cases, yes. But in general, it's actually the opposite that happened. Precisely because the world didn't support, or because America didn't allow other powers to support the Free Army properly, that's why the Islamists became so strong. Mm-hmm. And about the air defense, the anti-aircraft weapons, the thing which has driven half the population from its homes is aerial bombardment. Barrel bombs. And also Scud missiles and the rest of it. But it's helicopters, planes, Assadist and now Russian. If Assad had been incapable of doing this scorched earth policy, if he couldn't fly, there would have been no need even to bomb his palaces. Just bomb the airfields. Just stop the planes flying. Mm-hmm. Or if America doesn't want to bomb the airfields, don't, but allow the people to defend themselves with anti-aircraft weapons. Then there wouldn't have been scorched earth. You wouldn't have had the vacuum in which all these transnational mad jihadists would have jumped into and taken advantage of. You wouldn't have a huge refugee crisis. The democratic local councils which exist in Syria, which nobody seems to know about in the West, although we used to think a decade ago, supposedly, that Arab democracy was really important. We were prepared to invade countries over it. There's Arabs doing democracy. We don't know about them. We're not supporting them. Those people could have made a good example. They could have built an alternative which would have looked good, and that would have put Assad under real pressure even in his heartlands. So it might not have been necessary for the Free Army to invade his heartlands. Just by being able to exist and survive and make a democratic alternative, this would have tipped the balance.
Well, but it got to the point. The reason the Russians intervened was that Assad was close to losing it.
Absolutely.
And now that they have, so we're just in the last 5 to 6 minutes or so, let's turn to the present. And there does appear to be some complicity, to say the least, between the U.S. and Russia. The phrase often used is that Obama is leading from behind. What's your sense then, Leila, of where we're heading now, that Assad has retaken Palmyra and, you know, you've got the Turks in many ways, even though they've helped the creation of the Islamic State, now they're suffering blowback. But they probably wouldn't mind having more Arab population in the area where the Kurds are. Their obsession seems to be the Kurds. The Kurds, of course, are the only people that the West has found to be particularly useful against the Daesh, the Islamic State. So how do you see these so-called peace talks working out?
Okay, well, I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, Russian intervention has really shored up the abilities of the regime. The regime was losing a lot of territory before the Russian intervention, and now, due to Russian complete carpet bombing of cities, the Assad regime is in a much stronger position than it was a few months ago, and the Free Syrian Army is significantly weakened, because what we must remember is that the vast majority of Russia's airstrikes have not been targeting ISIS or the so-called Islamic State, but have been targeting these nationalist militias and the Free Syrian Army, and also the communities, local communities which are practicing democracy and democratically organising in their communities. So I think, yes, certainly going into the negotiations, the regime's hand is strengthened. The opposition is weakened, and Russia has now positioned itself as a major player in the Middle East. But what we must remember, as I've just said, is due to the attacks that Russia's been carrying out, so many civilians have been killed, civilian infrastructure has been decimated, so many hospitals have been taken out during the Russian airstrikes. And Russia is part of the problem. It's not part of the solution.
So how do you see things in the next few months? I mean, obviously, there's a cynicism in using siege, starvation, and the way that the intervention has been justified is that at least they're getting some humanitarian aid in. So it seems to be that what's happening is that people are settling for not having people starved and sort of turning a blind eye to the longer consequences of Assad staying in power, even though I understand there's a report in the BBC today that there's within the Alawite community, there's a restiveness now about Assad, that they've had enough of him, even though he's supposedly their protector.
I mean, the other reason why Assad helped to build up the jihadist threat, the first reason, as we said, was to scare the West into thinking that the only alternative to this guy was not democracy but jihadism. But also he wants to scare his own community, the Alawi community, religious minorities in Syria. Now, he depends on these people because 80% of the officers in the army are from the Alawi minority community. I think very many people in that community know that the guy is a criminal and that he's destroying the country and he's making it impossible for their children to live with their neighbors' children. They know this, and yet a lot of them have been terrified by the violence that he's created, by the sectarian backlash that he's created, that maybe the alternative are jihadists who will come and want to kill them just because they're members of religious minorities. So it's a very difficult situation. I think at the moment it looks like under Russian aegis, there seems to be some kind of idea of carving Syria up into zones of influence, which may be some kind of soft partition, which won't satisfy anybody on the ground. I think one thing that pro-regime Syrians and anti-regime Syrians can agree on is that they don't want their country to be carved up again, certainly not like this under the aegis of foreign powers. So it looks very depressing at the moment. On the other hand, as soon as there is a reduction in hostilities, I think the daily death toll is now down from about 120 a day a few weeks ago to about 40 a day at present. It's still awful. But with this slight reduction in the terror, we immediately see people coming back onto the streets in the liberated areas, not waving the black jihadist flags, but waving the Free Syrian flag, calling the original chants of the revolution 1-1-1, the Syrian people are one, calling for freedom and dignity. And immediately we see fault lines opening up quite dramatically between revolutionary communities on the ground, Democrats on the one hand, and Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda franchise, on the other. People in Idlib province have been demonstrating against the jihadists and against Assad at the same time. They've been pushing jihadists out of town. They've been calling on the Free Army to push jihadists out. So there is hope. The hope lies in the Syrian people, who remarkably, after 5 years of this, even with half of them homeless, they're still going. They're still calling for democracy and freedom. Now, geopolitically, because of the involvement of international states and transnational jihadists and the survival, sadly, of the Assadist fascist state, it looks really grim. On the human level, it still looks like it's all to play for, because so many Syrians, they've got this idea now, they've started speaking, they've paid such a high price to speak out and experience freedom and dignity, and they're just not going to stop. So I think the world's powers are going to have to kill every last Syrian if they want the desire for freedom and democracy to disappear.
I thank you both for joining us here in the studio, Robin Yassin Kassab, who's a regular media commentator on Syria and the Middle East and the author of the novel The Road from Damascus, and is also a contributor to Syria Speaks. And also in the studio with us is Leila Al-Shami, who's a founding member of Tahrir ICN, a network that aims to connect anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. They are the authors of the new book just out, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.